It's Ideasphere with Professor Joel Kotkin, From Disruption to Dystopia.
There are many sort of negative externalities that people don't talk about, which we should be talking about. I don't see this as a liberal issue or a conservative issue. I think it's an issue of the balance of the society. Do we really want to have these sort of concentrations of wealth?
Population growth is causing us to rethink our urban and suburban lifestyles, and with that, redesigning cities is a new fad. Hello, I'm Guy Rothbund. Welcome to Ideasphere, a platform for today's voices. Urban studies professor Joel Kotkin is not convinced that the frenzy for redesigning cities is good for everyone. In fact, he writes in his book, The Human City, Urbanism for the Rest of Us, that the designers do not consider the needs and desires of the vast majority of people. Joel Kotkin is a fellow in urban studies at Chapman University in Orange, California. He writes about demographic, social, and economic trends in the U.S. and internationally. David Brooks of the New York Times tagged Kotkin with the title America's Uber Geographer. And he joins me for this program. Thank you so much for taking this time.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Mine as well. I ran across your article in the Daily Beast, From Disruption to Dystopia, Silicon Valley Envisions the City of the Future, and I said, we have to talk. Over the course of my research, I found out that you've written several books on demographic, social, and economic trends,
right.
But the theme of your article and your recent book on urban development is that we're leaning towards densification, which you say
right.
is mostly a bad idea.
Which is, in other words, the idea that we want to encourage people to live in greater density and in many cases make it increasingly impractical and unaffordable to live in more moderate to low density. And I think that's sort of a big mistake. I think there's a market for density. I don't think it's a particularly large one, but it's, you know, it's a 10-15% of the population that's been that way for about 50-60 years. But that most people really want something that is a little bit lower density in terms of a urban environment. It may be townhouses or townhomes, which are quite, you know, popular in Houston, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could be a single-family neighborhood, which seems to be, from every survey, the vast preference, not just of the older generation, but of people once they get into their 30s.
Yes, and this is going right back to your article, because you begin that work with the technological oligarchs that are starting to emerge.
Right.
You write that the country's moguls are more divided now than any time in recent history.
Well, because what you have is a fundamental shift of power. And I wrote a book called The New Class Conflict that went into this, and I'm writing a book now that develops that further, that you really had your traditional, if you will, power elites, which were, you know, always Wall Street, but also the big car manufacturers, the oil companies, the aerospace companies. And those were really the leaders in our industrial world. But now we're moved towards a somewhat more post-industrial world and a more information-based economy. To our surprise, frankly, mine and many other people, this information economy ended up being much more concentrated, much more dominated by few players than, for instance, oil. Oil is a much more competitive industry with lots of smaller, thriving companies and big companies that battle each other and foreign competitors. Who are the competitors of Google, Facebook, Amazon? Certainly in this country, they really have no competitors. And so what we're in this situation, which Peter Thiel talks about, which is what he calls one and done. Somebody gets a lot of money from venture capitalists. They're on a very often an idea, some of which are fairly obvious, and they have an endless flow of capital. And so nobody else can really emerge. And if somebody starts to emerge, they simply buy them. So you've got this unprecedented concentration of wealth. Probably we haven't seen in 100 years, 120 years. As of now, these companies have had no antitrust violations. They basically could do whatever they want. And they're also very much concentrated in two regions, the San Francisco Bay Area and Seattle. So the other thing is the old industries, and particularly even the old tech industry, was very spread out. There were many, many areas. There were a lot more competition. Now we're really seeing oligopoly in a way that we really haven't seen. Again, you have to go back to the Gilded Age to see anything like it. So then you add this tremendous money. I mean, you know, if you look at who the richest people under the age of 50, they're almost all oligarchs in Silicon Valley or the Puget Sound. If you add the money with something that the old moguls didn't have, which was control over information, the ability of Google, for instance, to look for keywords in your email, or the tremendous amount of information that Amazon and Facebook and Google are collecting on almost a daily basis on people, is a kind of power that we really haven't seen. And now, I've written some more recent articles, now that maybe they're getting some bad press, their solution is to buy the press. So you have Steve Jobs' widow buying The Atlantic. You have techies buying The New Republic. You have Jeff Bezos buying The Washington Post. You have Google putting $300 million into journalism, you know, which, you know, I compare to giving a meaty beef shank to a starving dog. You know, so you've got this confluence of money and influence, and then being here in Southern California, they're beginning to take over a good part of the entertainment industry. So we've never seen this confluence of money and sort of cultural information power at the same time in the same hands.
And what we're watching at the same time, and you bring this out in reference to the moguls and the divisions there, these same moguls are starting to know more and more about us. They manipulate, as you say, our moods. And referencing that on the heels of your book is the revelations about Facebook and how they were using Cambridge Analytica.
Right, exactly.
Or the other way around, actually.
But they had been doing this in the past anyway. So this is not something that was unique, you know, just to Facebook and not unique just to Cambridge Analytica. I think what happened is they were embarrassed because it was something that helped Donald Trump. If it was something that helped Barack Obama, they would have been fine with it.
In case you're just tuning in, talking with Joel Kotkin, internationally recognized authority on global economic, political, and social trends, a book he came out with in 2017, The Human City, Urbanism for the Rest of Us, was published by Agate Press. We're discussing the information around an article recently in the Daily Beast, From Disruption to Dystopia, Silicon Valley Envisions the City of the Future. Mr. Kotkin, you have a website, blog, and anything else you want to use to promote your book and your articles?
Well, I have a website called www.newgeography.com, which has my articles and lots of articles that are related to it. I have a personal website, www.joelkotkin.com. And then for the group that the think tank that I'm the executive director for, which is in Houston, www.opportunityurbanism.org.
Great. I'll have those three links at Public Radio Exchange. So obviously you would have had challenges writing it down so quickly. Go to prx.org where you can hear the program from the beginning if you wish. And you can go to those three links at prx.org under Ideasphere, Joel Kotkin. Going back to what we were talking about, the densification of our areas right now, you find that as a negative, and there are many reasons, and we've just been able to touch the surface so far. But you say that redesigning the cities has become all the rage. Part of that is the shifting of the hardware and software that you reference into the merging of the physical and digital realms.
Right, and of course, like, if you think about people who have an Alexa in their house, I mean, you might as well ask the KGB into your house. I mean, they're collecting all your information. They don't really turn the information off. The sort of monitoring, as one British researcher has put it, we don't live in a surveillance economy. We live in a surveillance society where essentially the big money is being made by essentially eavesdropping on your life.
I can't help but think about one of the articles that you linked from your article on dystopia. And that was the woman who had set up the Alexia and all the other smart appliances in her house deliberately to have a friend and neighbor monitor all the information that was being collected by the various companies and how it was being used to track her as well as advertise and change her moods later.
Right. And of course, one of the big issues, of course, is the impact of this on younger people, which it seems to be to make them more depressed, make them more concerned about people's opinions, even people who are not part of their lives except online. So this is a very difficult situation because then they are now expanding into surveillance of neighborhoods and creating, in quote, smart communities in which every motion is being watched. And, you know, you can see this is most evolved in China, where I was about 6 weeks ago, you know, where they're doing facial recognition. You know, it is very much a kind of 1984, if you will, kind of environment.
It is. It just surprises me that we're able to easily move right into that and accept Facebook. And now that we have Facebook, why, we're open society. But what we don't realize is how much information we give away.
No, I think, and also what we're losing is a sense of privacy. You know, I find sometimes with younger people, sometimes that they don't really value their privacy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, besides the fact that I don't really care or want to know all the details of their lives, you know, I also don't want to be in a situation where somebody knows, you know, it's shared that, you know, I'm going out of town or I'm eating this kind of food, or the sort of barriers and sort of concentric circles that we used to have where, you know, there's information that you would share with your family and then with your close friends. And now it becomes shared with everybody. It's a very, very dangerous and potentially totalitarian kind of involvement.
And we're moving in that direction so rapidly that we're not fully cognizant of that. And I have to admit, I have not been totally in this world of information myself. The deeper I read into your article and all of the links to the various informational pieces you provided were eye-openers. One of the things that has always been a little thorn in my side, and I never could quite put my finger on it, was the use of campus, the Willow campus at Facebook, where folks are going to go live and be happily ever after. I read your article and you hit the nail on the head. It's the campus. We're always in college.
That's exactly right. And therefore, we never mature. First of all, we're living in a one-bedroom apartment, maybe sharing an apartment with other people. So let's face it, we're not going to have kids. We're not going to ever become adults. We're never going to be owners. So we're going to be rent serfs for the rest of our lives. And this is the kind of human being that the Facebooks and the Googles really are about. You could have had a job, let's say, working for Exxon or working for the Henry Ford. And yes, you know, he owned you for 8 hours a day when you went to work. When you came home, you went back to your house. That was your property. And maybe you bought some other real estate, or maybe you had a little side business. This is an all-encompassing way of life. And it's the idea that you're just, you know, you're essentially always a college student. You're always an adolescent. You never grow up. And this is the kind of behavior that is not very useful if you want to have a citizen-based democracy.
This is exactly what you write about the moguls, the leaders we were talking about at the top of the show. They're shifting hardware and software and engineering, and the thing they're tone-deaf towards are the actual existing people.
Exactly. People, see, I was talking to a guy who's been very involved in building housing that around the campuses. And he said to me, in his entire life, this guy's been around for quite a long time, he said, I've never met a group of people less equipped to deal with the social implications of what they're doing. You know, just think of who these people are. You know, they're very smart, but they're smart in a certain way. They probably don't have much knowledge of the Constitution. They probably don't have much knowledge of Shakespeare. They probably don't have much knowledge of classical civilization. Their historical knowledge is minimal. And that these are people who are pushing the buttons and controlling more and more of our society. Very few are classically educated. I mean, that's just not who goes into technology. And it's great to have this technology available. It has tremendous positives. But at the same time, if we do not have a group of people who have any idea of what reality is, when we look at their plans for development in the Bay Area and elsewhere, it's for a way of life that most people don't want to live. Once people get into their 30s, they want to live largely in a single-family home or a spacious apartment. Maybe they want a little bit of green space, and they want privacy. You don't want to have your neighbors knowing everything that you're doing. You don't want to live in an environment when you're in your 30s and 40s and you know, if you're going to have a family. And, of course, the great irony is these people who want everyone to live small live extraordinarily large. They have numerous houses. They have very big places where they live. They usually have two or three houses even in the same area. No, look, I don't begrudge that they have those things. But then to say that for other people, that's not an aspiration, that, you know, it's okay for me to live in, you know, have five or six houses, but boy, it's terrible for society and the environment if a, you know, middle-class person buys a home in Katy.
And you also point out, speaking of that, better for the environment is questionable, because when you do high-rise and you try to pack everybody in as closely as you can, it's actually more expensive for the building of those dwellings?
Between 3.5 and 7 times more expensive. And there are all sorts of negative externalities. Like, for instance, in most American cities, you know, not New York, or which is built a long time ago, but in a city like Houston or Los Angeles, when you get density, what you basically get is you get more congestion, which actually means more pollution because the cars are running. And of course, as you know, as we've built up these very dense areas, we have, you know, much worse traffic problems. So I think that they're not thinking of the implications that this has. And, here in California, I mean, they're basically trying to make it so single-family homes just cannot be built in any significant manner. And that's going to mean that people won't own anything. They'll obviously be much less likely to have children. There are a lot of negative things that, you know, they're not going to be homeowners. Therefore, they're probably going to be less a permanent resident of a particular area.
You already noted in your work that the birth rate is much lower in higher density areas.
Yeah, definitely. And I did a lot of work for the Singapore government on this issue, because this is one of the things that they're concerned about. They have a very low birth rate, and there's a direct correlation to the high density. Same thing in China. They got rid of the one-child policy, but it doesn't make a difference, because if you're living in a 30-story apartment building and it's expensive and it's one bedroom, you're not going to have kids. It's just, you know, maybe you'll have one, but you're not going to have a lot. And, you know, if you look at, let's say, Manhattan, the majority of households in Manhattan are, you know, not only childless, they're individual people. So what you're creating is a kind of society that is more like Brave New World, frankly, than anything we would like to see.
My guest for this broadcast is Urban Studies Professor Joel Kotkin. His recent book, The Human City, Urbanism for the Rest of Us, you can check out his websites at newgeography.com or opportunityurbanism.org, and his personal website, joelkotkin.com, the last name spelled K-O-T-K-I-N. This is Ideasphere. I'm Guy Rothbun. We'll be right back.